Welcome to the end of season two of the Raising Joyful and Resilient Black Children podcast. I'm Dr. Valerie Adams Bass.
And I'm Dr. Sharita Butler Barnes. And today, you all, we are going to celebrate growth and resilience in our children's journey as we reflect on an incredible season.
As we wrap up season two, I first want to express gratitude to our amazing co-host from the Parenting Joy Circle. It was a pleasure to have them join us throughout this season. And how has their perspective enriched our discussions? We want to talk about that.
Yeah, and you know, and even to answer that, I think that the plethora of experience that they provided in terms of being parents, but then also like their businesses and their, you know, we had a mom who was homeschool her children. And so we had pediatricians, part of our Joy Circle. So I think that was, I think that was pretty good. They offered a different perspective. We were able to also learn about what they did and also some of the wonderful things and traditions that they share and do with their families. I think that was awesome.
It was great. And, you know, we also had a chance to talk about how we celebrate holidays, particular winter season holidays. We have diverse experiences. So that was phenomenal. And then sometimes we circled back around to topics that we've discussed with experts, but really having our parent circle talk about it from a parenting perspective was also a wonderful opportunity to move away from what the research says and to hear our parents say, this is what it looks like when I'm doing this
with
my children. Or when I'm advocating for someone else's child. So it was great to hear that real-time experience. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think our co-hosts, though, have also, in addition to and to our wonderful Parent Joy Circle, our co-hosts have brought a wealth of knowledge and expertise to the podcast as well. And so let's delve into some key topics, right?
Yep.
Okay, so Carol Boston Weatherford and her son shared this beautiful book, their beautiful book, Kin, with us. How do you think their insights on family and heritage have resonated with our listeners and our Parent Joy Circle members? And even us as well.
Oh, gosh, Sharita, you know, I was so excited to have Carol and her son join our podcast and to really talk about the making of the book and what the book, what it looked like and felt like for them as family members to write the book, to illustrate the book, because Carol wrote the book and her son illustrated the book, right? So they really talked about that business aspect of working together. And I thought it was very thoughtful and very honest for her son to talk about, because this book had origins from their own family history, right? So the stories came from their own family history, and then they elaborated in some spaces and filled in. And so I thought that was phenomenal, right? To be able to trace their family history. But I think why it probably resonated with me and certainly some of our listeners is that it was first person history in addition to it being African-American or Black history, right? It was along the East Coast for our East Coast listeners, right? To think about that, the history that was being shared. And, you know, her son, you know, being a young adult himself was willing to say, you know, when I was a child before my mom and I moved into the space to write this book as an adult, right? He's an adult now. I really resisted learning this history. I resisted learning my own family's history. I resisted learning Black history, you know, because they have a wealth of history that they know first person generationally that comes out in this beautiful book. Not just the poetry of the book, but the illustrations are phenomenal. And to hear him really honestly say, this was not something I was interested in. I was dragged to the museums. I was dragged to the farms. I was dragged to these historical pathways. And then to come full circle as an adult and say, I now value that. And that is part of, you know, what I was able to contribute to this book, I thought was amazing, because in the time period that we're in, and hopefully our listeners can talk to us and share this recording as well as that one, you know, they're banning books,
right?
We know that they're banning books by and about African-American history, whether they're fiction, nonfiction, or children's books for kindergartners or high schoolers or middle schoolers. Two, they're taking Black history out of schools, right?
and watering down curriculum, absolutely, if it's not taken out, right?
Already, right, a deficit. So here you have this beautiful book of poetry that is bite-sized, and the images make it so, you know, visceral that you could have a conversation about this history in a meaningful way, mm-hmm. other than the traditional approach to Black history stories and Black history knowledge. So I think that hopefully resonated with our listeners to say, for those of us who have our history, for those of us who are seeking our history, for those of us who are just wanting to know and help our children to know and understand Black history at large, to keep going, right?
That's right.
It's now an adult. He didn't want to do it. We might have to drag them, right? We might have to, really literally drag them and say, you want to go anyway, or you're going to write this story anyway. But, you know, as an adult, he's able to say, I really did not, you know, I asked him, you know, what was exciting? He said, I wasn't excited, you know, as a child. So I think mm-hmm. hopefully the book is exciting, a dialogue piece, a conversation piece, could be a family reading piece, but also the idea that we must hold firm and fast to our own history.
We have to.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that, you know, we that's takeaway, you know, to grab the book, to read it, to talk about it, but also, you know, from the interview to hold fast and firm to our history and how we teach that history and share that history with our children. We absolutely always have to, but I feel like this is a Sankofa moment, right? In our history where we have to mm-hmm. look back. We have to reflect on a recent history as well as our long-term history and preserve that history in a way that is restorative, right? And girds the emotional and academic loins of our children, right? It gives them a buffer for all these other, you know, all these deficit approaches to teaching them to and perspectives about them. So absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. So that was, I mean, it was just exciting, as you can hear, hopefully my excitement.
I think it's good. And so we also talked to Dr. Alvin Thomas about Black fatherhood.
Yes, I was ready.
Adding on to that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, we definitely talked to Dr. Alvin Thomas out in Wisconsin about Black fatherhood, who also has a podcast on Black fatherhood. And, you know, thinking about what were some of those key takeaways from that discussion. And how might we continue supporting and uplifting Black fathers in our community, I would say? You know, maybe we can talk a little bit about that. How can we continue uplifting and supporting our Black fathers in our community?
That particular interview that we did, I think was a real eye-opener for me. Because here it is, you have a Black male who is a professor, who is doing research, but who also said, I am going to talk to everyday people just about their experiences around Black fatherhood, something that really quite hasn't been done the way that he's doing it. I mean, he's brought attention to Black fatherhood. I think it's refreshing, particularly in the context, the way in a way that our Black fathers are viewed. And I think Absolutely. It was something that was really beautiful. And I think one of the ways that we can do it is to, number one, we share the podcast, have a social media presence, but I think we can also honor our dads in the community. Mm-hmm. And I think community youth serving organizations can have fathers as mentors to others and to bring them in a way I think that would increase the visibility in a positive way. Because I don't know about a lot of programming that really centers Black fatherhood from like a strength-based lens. Or brings them in ways within schools and our organizations. So
I don't either.
In terms of visibility, I don't know of any.
No, I mean, most often I hear of, you know, fathers who themselves take hold of a community and decide to do something, right? And then that might be spotlighted organizations or individuals who say, I'm going to consistently highlight and spotlight the experiences or the mm-hmm. work of Black fathers to a community. We rarely hear about that. It's usually something organic that Black fathers have had to do because no one else is doing it. And they might get a 30-second shot on television or on a TikTok or a Twitter feed, but it's not a sustained and it's not really valuable valued in the same way. And that was one of the things that Dr. Thomas talked about, this deficit language around Black fathers and parenting. So I love that he really named it, right? This idea that Black fathers are absent, that Black fathers don't care, that Black fathers don't value being fathers, and how the guest on his show. So he does a couple of things that really honored Black fatherhood. You know, one thing is he has a variety of guests on his shows, from the everyday father who might be at the barbershop, to one of our notable jazz musicians, and those fathers who come on share the nuances of being fathers, right? So whether it's figuring out how to cook, or whether it's walking their child to school, or it's a disagreement. So he shared what it's like to be a father from all walks of life, right? So I love that about that, and I think we can look to honor fathers in that way consistently, right? And I would love to see, more of that work funded, right? In communities, funded. I would love to see more of that kind of research highlighted. We see a lot of research on Black families. We see a lot of work on Black mothers and lots of work on Black boys. And we don't want to miss Black fathers, right? So during fathers, it's Women's History Month. We're going to see women elevated. In May, we're going to see mothers elevated. And then, there's tongue-in-cheek jokes about how fathers are elevated for, Father's Day. So really thinking about, what Black fathers do and how they do it, right? And humanizing the experience. So it's not just a checklist. And I loved that, the podcast that Dr. Thomas has created and nurtured is humanizing Black men, right? Because that's talk often about humanizing Black children, and we don't often talk about humanizing Black men.
And I was also going to say, I would be remiss if I didn't mention here in St. Louis, they actually do have a Fathers and Family Support Center. And it's
nice, very program. Nice.
Oh, it's very nice. And it actually was started from a Brown School student back in the day who sort of noticed that gap. But this is an organization that does a lot of work around providing supports, understanding strengths, and all of that. So I'm glad to see that, because I was like, I do know of one here, and it happens to be in St. Louis. So shout out to them for sure.
Yep. Shout out to St. Louis for doing the good work. We are glad to hear it. And tag us when you share this podcast. Let us know what other father organizations.
That's right.
Father specific.
That's right. And you know what? And in thinking, that's information we can share too. Like, it's
absolutely
just through tagging.
So let us know. Yeah. Tag us. Let us know. We've got this fatherhood organization that's celebrated doing great work or supporting fathers. So we like to hear that, right? So that we can spread the word. Because, part of what we like to do is connect that research to practice, talk about what it's like to be a parent. Within the context of celebrating our children. And so that means, these additional resources that people are unfamiliar with, let's get involved. And that, I think, is the other reason why I liked, Dr. Thomas's podcast, because it was so, regular, anybody could listen, any Black father
anybody?
Can listen
that's right. That's right.
And feel affirmed versus
feel
attacked,
affirmed.
Right? Mm-hmm. I want to say that it seemed to me and in his listening base, right, that Black fathers can listen to it and feel affirmed and not attacked. And even, in our conversation, he talked about how there are some who are non-Black who say, wow, I listened to this and I have a different perspective on Black fathers, or it reminds me of my father. So that's that humanizing, right? Wow, my father does this, from his non-Black listeners. So, hats off to Dr. Thomas for doing the work.
Absolutely. And so now we talk about addressing microaggressions in the classrooms. So that was another topic for us, a very important topic. With the rich conversation of our parenting joy circle parent, we explored with Desiree Tucker. And so thinking about those topics, and I got a couple examples that we can talk about as well too, but how can parents and educators work together to create environments where Black children feel seen, valued, and respected? And so the situation I'm thinking about is the young Black man in Texas that was suspended for his hair and the recent ruling.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I got to take a deep breath.
Because we're thinking about, you have the Crown Act there. I mean, and there's other instances as well too. But when we talk about the extent to where children feel seen, valued, and respected, we can state it. I mean, we know what it looks like.
There's actions that go with that. Yeah. Right. So I have a story to tell. Then I think there's some things we could talk about. Well, now let me start by saying advocacy. And, you know, before I was a mother, I worked directly with young people, teenagers to be specific. And I would always say to my family and friends, like, even if your children don't go to these public schools, you pay taxes, right? Even if your children are grown, these kids live in our communities. So I think advocacy, so paying attention to, these guidelines, these rules, these incidents with children, and really advocating for those children. Even if your children are grown or you don't have children, they matter. And, tongue in cheek, we are seeing now how our children are our future and how they're seeing how we treat them and how they're figuring out how to move on to the next phase. So you can advocate for a child. When you hear about the Crown Act, when you hear about a young man who's suspended or his hair is cut, you can advocate for that child. You can jump into that conversation. You can send that school board. You can send that local congressman a note, right? So I think there's that. I would also say that's something that we might have to talk about, the Black community at large, because there are some Black people who will say, he shouldn't be wearing his hair like that. She shouldn't be wearing her hair like that. So let's talk about that internalized racism, right? So
We have to talk about it.
And I'm chuckling a little, not because it's funny, but because it's uncomfortable. So, as our listeners are hearing me, and I just had a conversation with some hopefully friends from Panama who are, I'll be visiting there for a professional conference in May. And so I've been working with them to really highlight the experience of Afro-Panamanians, which is how they identify themselves. And so the month of May, and Panama is equivalent to our Black History Month in February. So it's Afro-Panamanian month, if you will. And so one of the things that the gentleman shared with me, shout out to the West Indian Association in Panama, he said, a year or two ago, the children were being reprimanded from wearing their hair natural to school. But collectively, the Afro-Panamanians, right, which have diversity in group, but collectively, they lobbied and they came together. So this year, he said, as the children are getting ready to go back to school, they have a different calendar than we do. He said there are posters in Panama that say, go back to school with your Afro. Right. So there you have these posters throughout the country and some other advertisements advocating for the young people to now go back to school with their natural hair, with an Afro, which is before they were not allowed to. They were told they couldn't. And so now there's legislation, national legislation, smaller countries, but that they can. And not only the legislation is there, but talking about representation, they have posters and pictures and signage that says you can do this, you can be and express who you are. And so when we talk about that representation, which is why I say advocacy, right? Advocacy, it might be more at the national level, right? For us, the advocacy on a local level, communal level, getting into that school board, if you have a school board, working with other parents to do that work. And also that representation might look like going into the school, figuring out how to have that parent-teacher meeting, right? Making suggestions. Now, let me just say, schools will push back, but you keep on pushing. And I've said that
before. That's right.
When they're saying it's Black, when they're saying it's Black History Month and they're just doing, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, no disrespect. I honor them both. But we might want to have them talk about some of these other phenomenal Black history figures.
Absolutely.
And during Women's History Month, we want to make sure that there is quite a few Black women who are celebrated during that month, right? Those that are lesser known as well as those who are known. So that representation comes not only in how Black children are able to express themselves and visually, right, and how they speak, but also in what we see in that school, right? And so I think about my daughter's school. So for last year, I forgot that we did do Valentine's Day because I wasn't certain. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. But I found recently, and she, in fact, she was reading it today. She said, "Mommy, remember this from last year?" Because she was in first grade last year. So we did. Mm-hmm. Roses are red, violets are blue. Here's a treat and some Black history for you. And every kid in her class got a little Valentine's with a Black history fact about different the Black history people she wanted them to learn about. Like, who do you want to tell them about? She always says Malcolm X. But, you know, so that's where the representation came. And I said, I forgot this year. I forgot to include that this year. But, you know, one of the things that I noticed in her school, small steps might be, you know, we shouldn't settle for small steps, but if you see them making progress. So one of the things that I noticed that her school, for the high school students, their daily gram, if you will, or daily announcements, they were highlighting an HBCU. And the history of the HBCU, which I hadn't thought of that. But when I said, let me see what you're telling these high school students. And they were talking about Fisk. And I said, okay, that's better than
nothing.
Right? You know, so that representation can come in different ways. And I think we can advocate for that representation.
I think so too. I think so too. And it makes me think of like the late, because I was such a fan of the late Joe Madison, faithfully, right? And he always said, like, what are you going to do about it? And I love when you said that we all pay taxes, like we pay within these communities. So while our child might have went on, or our kids might be in a private, like we still have to show up and advocate for children to be their authentic selves and to be affirmed. I think that's something we all can do. And we have to. It's necessary.
We can all do that. Big in big ways and small ways.
It depends on small ways.
We can all do that. And sometimes it might mean volunteering, you know, and sometimes it may get tired of doing that, but or you know, you can volunteer again, whether you have children or not. Now sometimes schools are leery. I walked into a school when I was volunteering on the quote unquote payroll, like partnership, and they're like, "Who are you?" And I get that they want to be safe. And I'm like, "Well, I'm here for 4-H, right? And here's my ID." So you might have to go through some hoops if you are not affiliated. Well, and if you're affiliated to school, as I was, but it's worth it. Or you might say, I'm going to donate books for this class, or I'm going to come in and talk about it as, you know, someone who works for this corporation, or I do this or I do that. So we can do big and small. I think that representation can come in all those forms.
We can
do that work. And so then we had thinking about another guest that we had, you know, moving from representation in a positive way, you know, we had Kristen Henning, who joined us to discuss transforming juvenile justice. Mm-hmm. This is on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yes.
So what steps can we take to advocate for systemic change and really to ensure that the criminal justice system does not unfairly target our children, right? That they don't unfairly target our children. What can we do?
You know, I could just talk about what I've been trying to do as a researcher.
Okay.
Just as a researcher, just the things that, you know, we show up, we do what we do. I've been really working with in school districts and school districts that purport to be fair, but who are not fair, who are unfair. And this means pulling out numbers, showing them the discipline rates, showing them the presence of a school resource officer, who are the students that are more likely to be policed. Because while I think some districts get it, there are some that, you know, it's this difference between like sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity, I think.
Absolutely. Yep.
Right. Okay. Yep. And so they know some of these things are happening. And so I make it for me, this is what's happening to our Black boys. This is the way that Black girls are policed. Zero tolerance policies are not the answer.
Yep.
What can we do? No, if this child gets in trouble, they are not supposed to be in the back of a police car.
Yep.
And so that's the way that I've been trying to infiltrate within schools where there's these high numbers at. So that's the little piece, that I've contributed to in terms of what I can do.
Sure. Sure. These topics are so important, but also uncomfortable. So these are, you know, nervous chuckles for me. So a few things I think I'm going to stick with advocacy, but also information. So understanding mm-hmm. how the system works so that you can have a fairly, a fairly informed conversation with different people. So whether that's someone in your family or school that's board right. or parent or principal. And so I say that because recently, not to this subject, but recently within my own family, a recent, brief article had come out talking about, the wealth gap of African-American women compared to their peers, non-Black peers. And one of my sisters said, well, she refuted the article essentially. And I said, well, I'm going to give you a homework assignment. It's true because it was a soundbite. It was a short, brief article that didn't really go into the details of the data. And she had great questions. So it was a family friendly, non-barroom argument, but a barroom argument, if you will. So I said, well, I'm going to give you a similar assignment. So I give my students, I'm going to go and I'm going to find some research articles that are related to this topic. Now, everyone can't necessarily do this. I said, but we're going to read these articles. Then we're going to talk about it. Right. And really see is there a wealth gap and how do we identify and what can we do about it? So that might not be the experience that parents can say, I'm going to go find a research article, but we can surely, look into a contemporary article, or we can contact our local or see what our local legislators are saying, because they put out briefs all the time. So we can even get on their list, right? A simple thing to do is to get on the list of our local legislators, sure, our national, but our local legislators. Like a local legislator just recently said he's having a meeting about children and systems, right? And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And so, but I'm on his list. So I get his updates weekly, whereas you have to sign up for that list, right? And I'm in his jurisdiction. So I can see what policies he's working on or what policies other people in the state are working on. So one thing we could do is just get on there, follow them, their social media. Right. That's to find right. out what's going on. So it doesn't have to be, I'm going to go get a research article. We can follow our local politicians, social media. They send these updates and they always say, we want to hear from you. Well, send them a question. Right. Or say, what are you going to do about this? Or how does this affect me? Or is there anything I can do? Or if you have some knowledge or some resources, or you have a personal experience you can share with them, they're saying they want to hear from us. Okay, let's let them hear from us. So that's what I would say. Capital A or advocacy, with lowercase a, we could do it.
And you know what? And to your point, and as you were talking, I was trying, I listened to all these like I listened to Sirius XM a lot. And so recently, okay. And so I also know, and I'm blanking on it now, but when I find the information, I want us to share with our listeners. But there are also like organizations that do what you just said, like help parents. Like no child should be spoken to without a parent, like with in right. the presence of a police officer, like their parents should be, they have to, the advocacy of what to do when something happens. And so there are some grassroots organizations who are working with parents, who are working with youth to also sort of educate them sort of in this process as well, so they can know their rights as well too.
Yes.
But yeah, as you were talking, I was just thinking about that as well.
Right. So there are these advocacy organizations that will come out and be an advocate for a family, and they will explain all the language that we do not know, because most of us are not attorneys or not.
That's right. And it's resource sharing. It's resource advocacy and resource sharing. You're absolutely mm-hmm. right. Yeah.
So we can definitely make those connections. And I think sometimes, and people could be, I'm tired of politicians, but I do think at least at the local level,
that's right.
It's meaningful to reach out to them. And oftentimes they'll say, follow us and do this and do that. And so that's another space. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that it's always effective, but nothing beats a failure but a try, especially if we're not connected at the local level where it really matters.
That's right. And
the advocacy organizations that will advocate for families and also explain the language and explain mm-hmm. the options to you before you sign off on your rights, or you sign off on your parenting right. or your child is taken from. So all these ways. And then I think also, the professional development. So when Kristen was on our show, she talked about that toward the end. She talked about, the race, racism that's embedded in the system.
That's right.
And she talked about, educating, the employees who are in the system. in terms of the biases they have against Black children. And so, you know, helping them to understand that and again, to humanize. So we can talk on both aspects. Like, so perhaps there's a training that needs to happen in the schools as well as the social system. You know, like this is National Social Workers Month, I believe. So thinking about what does that training look like for the people who are encountering our children is also important.
That's right.
And you know that, you know, what you said you're doing on a what you can do as a scientist. I think about at one point a few years back, I was working with a colleague and doing the evaluation of her work. She does a lot of like peace-based work in schools. Oh, so in this school district, small district that has riddled with a lot of issues, I was looking at their, discipline data. And so I was carrying back their discipline data and these high numbers so we could talk about it within a context of this restorative justice initiative that they have been funded for. You know, the unfortunate part, as you said, some districts are aware and some districts aren't, is that the first time we showed them those higher numbers, the next time I feel like the numbers were so much lower within a quarter. I said, they're probably underreporting now that we have
shown them. That's right. Now that we've shown them.
You brought us in to do this restorative justice work and teach your faculty how to do the restorative justice. And then we compared that work with here are these high discipline numbers. And within a of a year, not another year, you know,
but within a quarter.
Next quarter, the numbers could have dropped drastically, right? This is underreporting. And so what do you do about that? I'm not certain, but, you know, part of it, what, you know, they did continue to do the restorative justice training.
Okay.
But, you know, how do you get them to, you know, one thing to think about is how do we get them to continue to honestly report? Right.
That's right.
Were you over-reporting because of you want to get funding and now, or were you really reporting and now that it's been called to your attention, you're under-reporting? I'm not certain.
So you won't be called out. Yeah.
It is important to figure that part out. Right. Yeah. So they were doing restorative justice there, but it's important to figure out how to help them understand and move from the zero tolerance policy. That's really not helpful. I can certainly agree with you.
Yeah. And so, important topics we're talking about. And so Takari Tatum
shared
his rubber band mentality approach to addressing youth mental health. Serious issue now.
Serious
issue. How can we prioritize mental wellness and resilience in our kids, especially in the face of adversity? I mean, we study this, right? But, And so how can we prioritize mental wellness? I mean, I have some thoughts.
I love that Takari was, you know, figuring out what could work for him at his age and actually what could work for adults too, right? So really using the rubber band to remind yourself to go through the process of centering, right? And I'm totally paraphrasing his approach and strategy. But, you know, this idea that the rubber band can help you to center yourself and be reflective about your experiences, right?
Yeah.
And so I think developing a practice, helping our young people develop a practice of centering themselves, whether it's when they're having moments of euphoria and joy or where they're having moments of discomfort or anger or anxiety or sadness. So it's developing a practice. So the rubber band mentality that Takari shared was not just the mentality, it was a practice that went along with it, right? With this rubber, like practicing, the centering yourself, being reflective. And so I think doing that is certainly going to be important. And then the other part of it, you know, seems so simple, but as parents, we also have to be reflective and as advocates and guardians is like pausing for a moment to really check in and observe our children.
That's right. And I was even thinking of the work, I mean, because I'm just speaking from a Missouri context because that's what I know. Sure. But I know some of our districts here for youth have developed like mental health curriculums as well, just to kind of guide and to have youth center themselves. Yep. I would like to see more of that in spaces, but challenges to the attack on social emotional learning now.
So,
topic, but still.
That's, Yeah, their right? classes, absolutely. There are some schools that have social emotional learning classes or had them on, you know, both. I'm aware of schools in Virginia as well as in Pennsylvania, the city of Philadelphia, where they have these social emotional classes that have become part of at least middle school and sometimes high school courses. What those, the content varies though from district to district.
That's right.
But there's this idea of social emotional learning. There's, you know, I had a colleague at UVA, Trish Jennings, who did some social emotional learning work around yoga in the classroom and some of her research and what that looks like, right? So, you know, I think social emotional learning has a broader definition than how we think of it in academia,
we're
talking about within Black communities. But this idea of centering, like social emotional learning has a lot to do with centering yourself, reflecting yourself, understanding where your emotions are and how your emotions are driving your behavior.
That's right.
Or how your behavior, you know, is impacted by your emotions. Like there's a lot of that built into that. So that could also, you know, be when children are, you know, quote unquote, acting out or being violent. Like what is triggering that? That could be like, it's, you know, a variety of things. That could be like when I'm exuberant and, you know, people are calling me loud, like what does that mean? But really centering self. And I think as parents, part of that is developing practices with our children, observing, you know,
that's
and teachers too, our teachers, our, you know, our laymen, you know, our spiritual homes, like
that's right. Stakeholders who engage with children on a daily basis, like the modeling is important as well.
Centering ourselves and also paying attention to the children and stopping and pausing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and right now there's so much going on in our world. It's hard to stop and pause. And, you know, we could talk about that on a whole nother episode in our next season. But it is hard to stop and pause. Mm-hmm. So we have to develop a habit of stopping and pausing and checking in on our children.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe a lot of the behaviors we see that aren't necessarily the most beneficial to them or us or our communities is a result of us not checking in enough.
Yeah.
Right. So we need to, and that check-in could just be an observation. It could be a conversation. It could be a hug. Right. It could be we're just doing something together mindlessly. And particularly when it comes to teenagers who you and I, you know, work with and you have teenagers now, this idea, you know, they might be shrugging you off. Right. But that's in some ways an expression of many teenagers. So that doesn't mean that you just disregard them. You're going to have to hang in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's why I say it's developing these habits that allow you to check in with your children. It's easier when they're younger to check in with them. But, you know, at all ages and stages of development, we have to develop a practice of checking in, centering ourselves, and also checking in with our children so that
and
we can help
in.
Them be well, right? Help them be well and help them check in on themselves. So when we're not around, they know how to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important.
Absolutely.
Super important. And, you know, we move from thinking about Takari, who at a very young age had to figure out how to center himself and how to help other people center themselves, including adults. He talked quite a bit about that and what that meant to him to be able to help others center themselves. And then we move to, you know, moving from Takari, a young man who just does this work at a young age, and he's just passionate and gives out his book to grandkids and his books as much as he can, to someone who's an artist and an advocate and does activism.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pleasant surprise and delight to interview her after I had met her, you know, before visiting her site. So Michelle Browder, she talked about art activism and advocacy, and she talked about, you know, how can, you know, what she does, how she blends her artistic expression with her advocacy, especially for children and youth. She works with lots of young people. So how can creative expression empower our children to become agents of change in their communities? What do you think about that, Sherita?
I mean, I think it's something that is important, but yet undervalued.
Yep.
I've seen students, particularly maybe like, I think middle or high school students that have used their art as a form of activism, whether it was through poetry, whether it was through acting or drawing or their writing. I loved it because there are some spaces that give voice to youth to do that. And I don't know if we do that enough. And especially considering that this is a totally different political climate that our kids are in today.
Absolutely.
Versus what we grew up in. And I'm just thinking about expression. I'm thinking about the removal or the lack of art classes in K through 12 education in some spaces, because, you know, with funding, those are some of the first things to go. And I just wonder how our children learning how to express themselves, right?
Right. And, you know, I think of two things. One space that young people are expressing themselves is in social media spaces.
Right? Oh, absolutely.
They're advocating for themselves. They are not just in words, but, you know, the videos that they create. So they're using technology to express themselves artistically in ways, both, you know, whether it's performance or visual technology, in ways that we have access to and that they don't necessarily have access to in school, right? So that's happening. And unfortunately, as you said, many of the traditional public schools are losing art and losing performance art, losing visual art. Yeah. So, you know, creating space for young people in our homes, in our communities, in our churches, in our mosques, in our synagogues, in our temples, you know, in our community centers, in our senior centers, in our libraries, to creating those space in community for young people to be artistically expressive.
And to thrive in doing it. Absolutely.
And absolutely. I think, you know, young people have stories to tell. They've, you know, historically we're storytellers. And so allowing them to tell those stories using their own language, but creating the spaces for them to do that, introducing them to different forms of art. So whether it's music, whether it's visual, whether it's photography, you know, introducing them to various art forms and figuring out which one they catch hold of, really.
That's right.
Maybe it's gaming. Maybe it's creating games. I don't know. But I think part of them, you know, becoming advocates or using the artistic expression for advocacy is introducing them to art.
That's right.
Right. And, you know, Michelle talked about when she went to college, you know, how, you know, she didn't continue because she was always an artist, but she also had the motivation to elevate the experience of Black people. And she had art teachers in college who were like, not so much, right? Mm-hmm. And so for her, some of the history that she was introduced to, she wanted to illuminate and say, this is important. So which is why I say she had been exposed to the art. So exposing them to the art so that when they do rub up against experiences that they want to tell, they have the skills or they can continue to grow skills to express themselves, right?
So and then share that with others too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And they can share it with others. And then, it, you know, I mean, I think we can all do that, you know. And I think as parents and caregivers, you know, sometimes goes back to our earlier conversation where centering ourselves and taking a moment to do that with them, right?
That's right.
No, we do. Sometimes we will have to do things that we don't necessarily know how to do or want to do or feel like we have time to do to support them, right? Because we do want them to be joyful and we do want them to be resilient. And being, you know, being able to express themselves artistically is part of that joy, right? Elevating that joy quotient is so important. And that's one of the things that Michelle talked about. You know, she almost was taking words out of my mouth because I often say you have to be safe, you have to dance, and you have to laugh every day. You've got to.
That's right.
Like joy quotients, right?
Right.
You know, is does rowing count? I said, does rowing bring you joy? Then it counts, right? You know, so that joy quotient is important. So I think for us, we're often preparing our young children, particularly from their racialized perspective, we're preparing our children to live in society where we have these extreme racial biases, especially now. Yeah. And the joy part is when we introduce them to art and let them have at it, right? The joy part is where we teach them to center themselves and to laugh, right? Mm-hmm. And so we want them to have both so that when they're having these difficult moments, they also can experience the joy of these other moments as well.
That's right. So no, I think that we had a wonderful season to end it on elevating joy. I think it's absolutely magnificent. And so in closing, thank you everyone for joining us. Thank you to all of our listeners for being with us on this journey of growth and resilience with our amazing Parent Joy Circle family as well. We look forward to continuing these critical conversations in season 3.
A special thank you to our guests and co-hosts for sharing their wisdom and passion. And until next time, let's keep celebrating the joy and resilience in our children's journey. We invite you to follow, rate, and review our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Your feedback helps us to reach more listeners and continue providing valuable content.